As humans have spread across the world, so have infectious diseases. Even in this modern era, outbreaks are nearly constant. Though not every outbreak reaches pandemic level, as the novel coronavirus COVID-19 has, epidemiologists, the scientists who track the incidence and spread of diseases, are always on the lookout for the next big outbreak. But predicting the future is always tricky, so they often look back to the past. Fortunately, I, Darren Grimes, have the IEA's in-house historian and head of education, Dr. Steve Davies, with me today to take us through the history of pandemics and what they can tell us about what we're living through today. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Darren.
Now, Steve, I want to start off. I come across this stat earlier today. The World Health Organization have said it took 67 days from the first reported case to reach the first 100,000 cases, 11 days for the second 100,000 cases, and just 4 days for the third 100,000 cases.
Yes.
Is there historical precedent for a spread this fast?
Absolutely. That is actually the rate of spread that you would normally expect to have in an epidemic disease, by definition, actually. By definition, an epidemic is an outbreak of an illness where each case for a while gives rise to two further cases. Now, what that gives you is exponential growth, which is the pattern you've just described there. Now, this doesn't go on forever, because if it did, the entire planet would become infected in very little time, in fact. What happens after a while is that usually when you've got to about 60% of the population having had the disease, the number of people who've had it and recovered is so large that the pathogen, the disease-causing organism, virus or bacterium, can't find any new susceptible people to spread to. Because for anyone who's got it, most of the people around them are going to be people who are either naturally immune or have already had the illness and therefore are now immune. So you have very, very rapid growth, accelerating growth and exponential growth up to a certain point, at which point the curve starts to flatten out and you reach a peak and thereafter the epidemic declines. So that's the normal pattern for an epidemic outbreak.
So would this kind of, it has caused a massive supply side shock. Would this be familiar to our ancestors who've gone through this sort of experience in the past?
Well, yes and no, with a slight amendment. Yes, it would be very familiar. Major plagues, major outbreaks of epidemic illness were a constant feature of our ancestors' lives, sometimes on a local scale, sometimes on a truly global scale, as with the 14th century Black Death. And what those did was to cause an enormous hit to the supply side by killing large numbers of people and by also disrupting trade routes, disrupting work, disrupting farming and production. With the Black Death, there was suddenly an acute shortage of peasants and there literally were not enough people around to do a lot of the farming that had to be done. So, yes, they would be very familiar with this. What they also faced was supply side depressions, if you will, brought about by things like natural disasters, severe adverse weather conditions, which maybe destroyed lots of crops, or by wars and the devastating effects of wars. Now, for us, that's unusual. In the modern world, most major slowdowns, particularly in the 20th century, are caused by something which affects demand, usually a financial crisis of some kind or other, sometimes the government's mistaken response to that financial crisis. What we have here is a supply-side shock of the kind our ancestors would be familiar with. However, there is one important difference. In this case, it's not that lots of people have died that is a supply-side shock, fortunately, nor is it that the physical assets have been destroyed. Rather, it's that in order to control the spread of the disease, governments have taken measures, social distancing, outright quarantine, lockdowns, and things of that sort, which have brought about a supply side contraction, a big one. And in a sense, that's deliberate. You want to do that in order to check the spread of the virus. Now, the way that's working is not through the assets, because the assets, the buildings, the machinery, the land, the plant, that's still there. Mm-hmm. What is being severely disrupted is the human relationships the human connections that make those physical assets productive. Now, that also happened in the past, majorly with things like the disruption of trade routes. But in the modern world, that's the primary form that the supply shock takes.
Yeah, and speaking of the economic response to it, have we ever seen anything like this before? Obviously, we, in the age of globalization and global supply chains, surely the impact is much bigger, isn't it? The government response has been much bigger than anything we've seen in the past.
Yes, that is true. In the 20th century, we've had four or five major pandemics, mostly of flu, and those killed a fair number of people, but nothing like as many as the coronavirus might do, because the lethality of the viruses that caused them, like the Hong Kong flu at the end of the 60s or the Asian flu in the 50s, was nothing like as high as that of the COVID-19 virus. So although they did cause, you know, quite a bit of disruption, and the economists have worked out just how much it was, it wasn't as massive as this is likely to be. So with both the Hong Kong flu epidemic and the Asian flu epidemic, you were talking about a 2 to 5% hit to global production, which is significant, but it's not really, really big. The last one that had a comparable economic effect was the great Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 to 1919, which it's hard to work out exactly what the economic effect was, because, of course, it happened at the end of a devastating world war. So it's hard to disentangle the effects of that epidemic from what the war had done already. But it was very considerable. It was something like, we roughly guess, a 10% hit to global output.
Yeah. And I wonder, Steve, if you can explain why it is that if we look at the history of pandemics, they tend to occur at the end of a period of increasing trade and economic integration over a large part of the planet's surface.
Yes, well, the reason for that is quite simple, is this. When an epidemic breaks out, when a disease starts to spread in that exponential fashion, there are two things that limit or check the degree to which it spreads. The first is the actual nature of the pathogen itself. And here, we're rather unlucky at the moment, because normally, severity of the illness and lethality, the degree to which the illness kills you, is inversely correlated with the infectiousness of the illness. Now, that's straightforward, because if the virus or bacterium kills you, then, and kills you very quickly, then you aren't going to be infect many people. Conversely, if it gives you just a mild illness, then you're going to infect a lot more people. So normally, if a bacterium or virus is very deadly, you're not going to infect a lot of people. Conversely, with, for example, like the swine flu epidemic we had in 2009-10, it's highly infectious. It's not going to be very harmful. Unfortunately, you do occasionally get episodes where the pathogen, in this case the COVID-19 virus, is both very serious and highly infectious. That's very unusual, and it usually means that you're dealing with a new pathogen, a mutated virus or a mutation in a bacterium. So that's the first naturally limiting factor. The other limiting factor is the degree to which people A, live close together, and B, actually can come into contact with each other. Now, if you're living in a world, take a kind of hypothetical extreme, where everyone is living in isolated farming households and they hardly see their neighbours more than once a month, the disease isn't going to spread very much, because there simply isn't enough contact, and the contact isn't long distance enough. Yeah. If, on the other hand, you live in a world where there's a lot of trade, a lot of long distance travel, a lot of people living together in large cities that depend on trade, then the disease is going to spread, and it's going to spread typically, this is the historical pattern, along major trade routes. If you look at all the great pandemics in the past, they're typically spread along both maritime and land trade routes. And what you find is that financial and trading hubs, the large cities that are the center of the world economy of the time, are the ones that are most severely hit, that become, in the initial phase anyway, the places where you get really big outbreaks. So you see that with Florence in the Black Death. You can see at the moment that the cities that have got very unusually high levels of COVID-19 infection are places like London, Milan, Paris, New York, which has almost half the cases in the United States. And these are all globally connected cities. So having a global globally connected economy with lots of travel, lots of trade, means that the pathogen has more chances to spread. And it means that it tends to spread to the limits of that trade system. So in the very famous pandemic of the 7th century, the just plague of Justinian, it spread via trade links all around the Mediterranean. And that was the initial extent of the pandemic spread. Later on, it started to spread beyond that. But that's the pattern. Now, you might think that therefore, that increase in physical health, have more resources, knowledge, and capacity with which to fight the epidemic. So on the one hand, all those connections make it easier for the pathogen to spread around the world. But on the other hand, the wealth that those connections have brought means we're in much better position to fight it and to come up with ways of dealing with it. So it's not a straightforward sort of all downside relationship. There is one thing I would add, which is that major pandemics often arise from viruses or bacteria jumping from one species to another, typically, therefore, from animals to humans. This appears to have happened in this case. Now, what that means is that the places where such novel pathogens originate tend to be places where the human world, if you like, butts up against the natural world. So the just plague of Justinian began in East Africa, for example. The Black Death began either in Central Asia on the steppes or more possibly in northern Burma, in the rainforests of northern Burma, southwest China. What is going on in the modern world that makes a major outbreak of this kind much more likely is modern intensive livestock farming, which is a very fertile breeding ground for novel pathogens. That, by the way, is where Spanish flu probably started from, because it actually broke out initially in Kansas, of all places. It's only called Spanish flu because of the way it was reported.
Well, speaking of the have there been in history backlashes against international trade because of these sorts of outbreaks?
Well, you know, yes, I mean, yes, historically there have. And historically, the really big ones, the Black Death, the Plague of Justinian, the Great Plague that hit the Roman Empire in the second century, early third century, the so-called Antonine Plague, these did lead to a major reduction in long-distance trade links, not least because they typically killed merchants at a higher rate than almost anybody else because they were the most likely to be exposed. Mm. The ones we've had in the modern world have not had such a big effect because the modern economy is more robust because of the greater wealth it has than the economy of our ancestors. So there's been a setback. The Spanish flu played a major part, I would argue, in the setback to global trade that took place after World War I. But in many ways, it's more the political response to pandemics in the modern world that actually brings about the bad results, as opposed to the way this worked in the past. So the answer is yes, it does have that effect. But in the modern world, it's more the politics of it than the biology that has that result.
Do you predict there being a bad response as far as the politics are concerned?
I fear there will be. I fear that what this is going to do is to intensify trends that were already in place before the pandemic started, such as a move towards greater protectionism, which we could see with the trade war between the US and China, a move towards greater economic nationalism. And I think what it will do almost certainly is bring about a major interruption to global travel and transport, because this is probably going to be with us for about 18 months. It will be about 18 months before either we get a successful vaccine or the virus naturally mutates into a milder form, which is what viruses tend to do. And that means that for about 18 months, global travel is going to be very difficult, because even if you manage to eliminate the virus within a particular part of the world, as China seems to have done in Hubei province with its severe lockdown, as soon as you relax it, it will tend to come back in from other parts that you haven't controlled. And obviously, given the virus is all over the planet, you can't possibly control it everywhere. So I think we're going to see severe restrictions on foreign travel for quite some time. And that's likely to have a long-term effect, I think.
So, Steve, you're basically saying that Extinction Rebellion have had all of their birthdays come at once?
In terms of like stopping people flying, yes, I think you don't need to go on about flight shame anymore. I think there's going to be a major reduction in long distance international travel over the next 18 months to 2 years. It may well recover after that. That will depend on how people react to this and a number of other factors.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get on later to how much of this is actually led by the response of consumers themselves and whether or not, you know, government policy is actually necessary, because people seem to be taking these precautions themselves out of fear of getting the virus and spreading it. But I wonder, have outbreaks such as the coronavirus led to a serious shift in employment, the way we live our lives, and essentially our entire value system? Because if you think of the very high levels of employment that we currently enjoy, with most households having two adults in employment, or the single adult in many cases, which you've written about before, the impact of closing schools and nurseries could bring about a big societal shift, couldn't it?
It could indeed. Now, it's worth saying, to address your more general point first, that in the modern world, the pandemics that we've had, because of their relatively mild nature, they've not had a major effect upon the economic or employment structure. The Black Death, on the other hand, brought about a radical change in the whole structure of work and class relationships and production in Europe, because it basically wiped out so much of the peasant class that the ones who survived enjoyed an enormous boost to their income. Because before the Black Death came, there'd been a shortage of land and a glut of peasants, if you will. And after it swept through Europe, there was the opposite situation. There was lots of spare land and there was a shortage of peasants. And the result was a major transfer ultimately of wealth and economic income from the landed aristocracy to the peasantry and the artisan class. So there was a complete change in the way agriculture worked. It took quite a while, but it was brought about by it. Now, will the coronavirus have a similar effect? I tend to think that what it will do mainly is to, again, accelerate trends that were already underway, such as a move towards more home working, more distance and virtual connections and things of that sort. But I do think that it will also reveal that certain things, certain arrangements we have, are just too fragile. They maybe work very well normally, and they may even make society more productive, but what they do is to make society very susceptible to major shocks of this kind, which we have to expect, I'm afraid. And the one you mentioned is one of them. Simon Wren-Lewis at Oxford University did a paper a few years ago in which he tried to model the economic impact of a major flu epidemic. And what he discovered was that if you put school closures into the model, it more than trebled the hit to GDP. Now, the reason is because of the factor that you mentioned, which is when you have an economy where pretty much every household has two working adults in it, even when there's children in the household as well, the impact of closing schools is much, much greater, because it means that somebody who's in paid work has to either work less or even stop work completely to look after the children. Now, having very high employment levels makes all kinds of sense in normal conditions, because it means more people being productive and doing productive work. But it also does, I think, on the evidence, leave society much more vulnerable to a major shock of this kind. So I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't quite some serious rethinking about this, not least because, to go back to the theme of accelerating trends that are already in place, I think we had pretty much reached the limits for employment. We were about 76 to 78% of all adults were in paid employment the last time the ONS reported. And I think that's pretty close to the maximum it can possibly be. The 22% who aren't are either old, sick, in full-time education, or disabled. So I don't think you would have been able to get it much above where it was anyway. So it probably was due to fall back slightly in any case.
Mm. So then what does history suggest the political impact could be on different regimes around the world? If you think about totalitarian regimes, can they survive pandemics, or does the threat undermine their very authority? And conversely, I think, can open democracies such as our own survive the sudden and dramatic imposition of supposedly, arguably necessary, but supposedly time-limited authoritarianism?
I actually am more optimistic about that thing than I am about the economic effects of the virus. I think that when you compare the response of autocratic or authoritarian regimes and democratic and liberal regimes to major threats, such as a pandemic or a war or a natural crisis, what actually emerges is that although initially it looks as though the authoritarian regime's doing better, over the medium to longer term, open, pluralistic, democratic societies do much better because they're better at correcting mistakes. They don't persist in errors. They have a discovery procedure through free discussion, which enables them to come up with better, more effective solutions. And they are simply more productive and more able to organize production and creative activity of all kinds. So I think that actually you will see over the course of the whole 2 years that the democratic parts of the world have actually done much better in this. That said, what this is like a huge stress test for the political order and particular individuals or governments or parties or systems will be found wanting, others will be found to have worked effectively. Now, one interesting question is what happens in China. The Chinese government outrageously concealed the news that there was a major outbreak going on in Hubei province for several weeks until just after Chinese New Year, which was quite frankly scandalous, both in terms of the risks it put its own people at and the rest of the world. Since then, it's imposed extremely draconian measures, and it appears to have actually contained the outbreak within Hubei province. Now, the big test for the Chinese Communist Party is going to come in the next few months, and particularly the autumn, because if the virus returns, which it quite likely will do, unless they completely seal off China from the rest of the world, and maybe even if they do that, then that could actually call their legitimacy into question. You know, here's hoping. It's worth pointing out that historically in China, major epidemics are one of the classic signs that the ruler has lost the mandate of heaven. And if that kind of idea gets root amongst the Chinese population, things could get seriously interesting for Xi Jinping and his colleagues. Now, on the other hand, I think certain, you know, countries will, the experience will be that maybe their institutions didn't shape up too well. But it's hard to say how that is at the moment because we're only in the very early stages. But overall, I actually think this is going to reinforce the correct perception that pluralistic, open societies with free discussion and democratic politics are actually more resilient and better able to handle major challenges than rigid authoritarian ones.
What do the historical precedents tell us the likely results of this will be when it's finally over in about, what, 18 months' time?
Yeah, well, hard to say. All kinds of things. As I suspect, I do think that it's going to have some pretty bad economic results. I think it's going to lead to a major revival of nationalism and a major revival of economic nationalism and a move towards reducing economic integration, at least for a while anyway. On the other hand, it's going to undermine the legitimacy of some political systems. It's going to strengthen the legitimacy of others. It will have all sorts of completely unforeseeable political effects. In the past, major epidemics often had a major effect because they killed people. So lots of important people would actually die from the plague or whatever it was. That's less likely to be the case now because of modern medicine. But even so, there will be all kinds of very unexpected political turnouts in the next few years. Very hard to predict what they are at this early stage. What you can say is that it will shake everything up. That's the kind of one thing you can be certain of, because lots of things that look to be completely, you know, unshakable or immovable will suddenly not be so. Lots of things that were thought to be beyond the bounds of possibility in all kinds of directions will suddenly become quite feasible. So I think, for example, we're going to get a lot of discussion about a universal basic income in many countries now. On the other hand, that's equally going to provoke a very strong pushback, and not just from the free market side or the political right. It will also come from important sections of the political left. So I think that's going to become a big debate in the next year or so. Hard to say how it will go, but that's definitely going to now become a serious argument rather than one that only people who work in the think tank sector are bothered about.
Yeah, like a fringe issue.
Yes.
Finally, Steve, you've argued major epidemics have pronounced psychological and cultural effects.
Yes.
I wonder, what have they been in the past and what could they be this time around?
Well, that's very interesting because if you look at the major pandemics we've had in the past, we know quite a lot about what the cultural and psychological impact of the Black Death was, for example, or what the impact of the plague that struck Athens during the Peloponnesian War was, because Thucydides has a very powerful, gripping section of his History of the Peloponnesian War, which describes it. You find that there's typically two contrasting psychological and cultural effects. Although human beings being the way they are, often you find both effects in the same person. One of them is what you might call a turn to seriousness, which takes the form of a revival of serious thinking and very often of religious belief. It may not take that form today, but that's the form it took in the past, where people think, look, enough of all this frivolity and excess. Life is too damned serious for all that. How about, you know, doing things more seriously? You also very often get a feeling that, well, somehow we have brought this on ourselves by our wicked ways and we need to change our ways. So I suspect we're going to see a lot of that. On the other hand, you also get a lot of people who say, hey, this tells me life is really uncertain and very insecure. I'd better just live for the day and eat, drink, and, you know, do all anything else that comes into my mind, basically, and not hold back on any of my desires. So you get a strange kind of bifurcated cultural response, which is a growth of short-term hedonism and living for the day on the one hand, and on the other hand, a turn towards a much more serious-minded and focused approach to life, if you will. What I do think is going to happen is a lot of the things which many people were wasting a lot of time obsessing about or worrying about in the last decade or so are suddenly going to seem staggeringly trivial. So I don't think we're going to be having so many big arguments about what pronoun to use to describe somebody in the future. I think, you know, when you're confronted with this kind of situation, that suddenly seems really, well, silly is the only word for it. On the other hand, I think the kind of religious sensibility that Extinction Rebellion represents, and I think it is a kind of quasi-religious sensibility, that might well see a big uptick. So I think we probably will see quite a lot of people saying, look, this means we have to completely change the way we live. We have to, you know, metaphorically flagellate ourselves and adopt a much more austere way of living. Most people are not going to accept that, but I do think we will see an upsurge in that because that's part of the turn to seriousness, the emergence of groups like that.
Well, Dr. Steve Davies, thank you very, very much. That was fascinating. And I'm sure everyone watching this will be absolutely, or listening to this, will be absolutely desperate to subscribe. So do hit the subscribe button. We will be doing another podcast on what we think of the response to the coronavirus so far. Steve, where can people find you on Twitter?
What's your name? I'm at Steve365 is my Twitter handle.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.